Cairo, Seattle.
It's time to get schooled with a professor, Sean Clayton.
Joining us on Schooled with a Professor is Drew Bledsoe. And boy, we have so much to talk about because so many things are going on, both on off the field for you, which of course you've been off the field, but of course we want to go on the field. And we also wanted to go into high school and college and look at how your sons are doing. So we've got plenty to talk about. But let's start off. One of the discussions here at the station was basically talking about what's it like to rebuild a team. And of course, I've probably been overly critical of the Cleveland Browns because they've been struggling for so long to get it right, and right now they've won one game in 2 years. When you went to the New England Patriots, how similar was it in 1993 to what was been going on here in Cleveland for the last several years to try to turn around a franchise?
You know, it's interesting. I was able to be sort of a part of that type of a situation in college at Washington State where they hadn't had much success, and then same in New England where, you know, got there and there hadn't been much success, and thankfully in both instances, you know, ended up having at least some measure of success before we were done. And I think that the overriding theme, if a team is going to be successful in turning around, is you have to have a big picture plan for where you're headed and how you're going to get there. You know, it seems like some of the organizations that continue to struggle, it doesn't seem like there's a big picture plan for what they're doing. They're just going to, well, we're going to go sign these free agents, and then we're going to draft this flashy quarterback, and then everything's going to be solved. And that's really not the way you do it. You've got to build internally, and you've got to build through the draft, and you've got to develop and train players, and you have to have a clear system in place for how you're going to approach that. And to me, it just doesn't seem like the Browns have had that. I mean, geez, you look at how many quarterbacks they've had come through there.
Yeah, in fact, this week they went to Kevin Hogan. That's their 28th quarterback now starting since 1999. And then you've seen through the years, particularly with Jim Haslam, he's come in, waited a year, fired the coach, fired the general manager. Now they're in the second year of trying to do analytics, and you can just see that you watch the team and you see, but the talent level just isn't there, and it's not good. And so here's DeShone Kizer going out there as a quarterback trying to work with virtually no receivers, and he gets benched after 5 games. When you went to New England, could you sense that they had a vision of what they wanted to do?
Sure. Yeah, they did. And then when Robert Kraft bought the team, you know, after my rookie year, he came in and he really applied just sound business practices to how he set the team up. And that team has been well-guided from the very, very top from the start. And there's a clear plan in place for how they're doing. Obviously, that's morphed and changed over time. But, you know, you look at all these quarterbacks that come through. I mean, John, you know, these quarterbacks are not, they're not bad players. I mean, you know, you get to be an NFL quarterback. You know, some guys are better than others. But you get to that level, you're a pretty good player. And certainly 28 of them aren't bad players. They've just been in a bad situation, you know, with no structure. And if you're continually changing everything, continually changing coaches, continually, you know, changing quarterbacks, you know, that goes to the highest level of the leadership in the organization.
But here's where the difference, at least when you came into the league, I mean, the systems in college was at least somewhat similar to what's there in the NFL right now. The current college game with so much spread offense, which of course is great for the college coaches because you can take guys, get them in quicker and get immediate productivity. It just doesn't translate into the NFL because they have to come up. They have to learn what it's like to be in a huddle. They hadn't been that way. They have to learn what it's like to take a snap from center because everything's out of shotgun. And really everything's just called from the sidelines and there's almost no communication. And so you're on a constant change trying to catch up to the NFL. And that's where a lot of the young quarterbacks in the league fail.
Yeah, they do, and I think that's where, you know, but there are guys that have success. I mean, you look at Marcus Mariota, who's really doing well, you know, with the Titans, but he had to come in and they had to train him, you know, how to do that stuff, and then he had to embrace it and learn how to do it. And, you know, I think that the teams have to understand that, okay, if you bring a kid in that's been in that offense, you know, some guys can progress really quickly through that and be ready to go, and some guys are going to take a little longer. And I think that, you know, these teams have to be patient and understand that you know, sometimes a guy is going to need a year or two before he's comfortable in a pro-style offense. And you know, for them to have to make a knee-jerk reaction, maybe play a kid too quick when he's not ready, and then immediately fire him. Well, now you brought a kid in, threw him in there, and now you're saying, well, it's your fault you weren't ready, even though you've never been in this kind of offense. And then you can really start messing with a kid's confidence and really, you know, spoil his future.
So when you got to New England, what did they tell you was the vision, and how did they follow through on that? Because obviously with an ownership change, there was going to be
In terms of, I mean, they didn't share a lot with me. I was 21 years old. They didn't share a lot with me in terms of their big picture vision. But in terms of how they approached the game, you know, with me, you know, they was protection first. I mean, we would keep extra guys in to make sure that I wasn't getting hit a lot. You know, we would run the ball a ton and, you know, try to hit some play action stuff. And then if we got to third and long, you know, we would maybe, you know, take a shot at something, but punts were okay. And they just didn't put me in a situation, at least early on, where I was getting hit a ton. And then, you know, then by my second year, you know, I was ready to go. And then, you know, and then they let me out, and we led the league in passing attempts my second year, and threw for a bunch of yards and made the playoffs and so on. But I think there was a plan initially. I know my very first preseason game, for example, I didn't play until the second half, and we were playing against the Chargers. And what they did was they had already told the Chargers that, you know, while the Chargers defense was going to put their backups in and their second team players and guys were going to try to make the team, they left the first offensive line in for us to make sure that I had good protection when I first hit the field. So they did, you know, there were some subtle things like that they did early on that allowed me to have some success. And then the other thing, John, that I think that teams miss, and the Patriots were actually guilty of this during the time that Pete Carroll was the head coach there, some teams when they fail, they get tied up in numbers, in 40 times and vertical leap and you know, bench press and those kinds of things. And it turns out that those things don't matter that much. What they really need to be looking at is they need to put on the film and see if a guy's a football player, and then they need to do a lot of background and determine what kind of character a guy has. Because ultimately, you know, if you're good enough to be considered for the NFL, you've got enough talent. And then beyond that, you've got to look at, you know, a guy's character, his determination, his work ethic, his intelligence, you know, those kinds of things. And those are not measurable with a stopwatch or a measuring tape. You know, and if you look at the guys that the Patriots have been really successful with over the years, you know, a lot of them, you know, if you just put them at the combine, are not guys that you would that you would jump out at you, but they end up being really outstanding football players because they're high character, you know, high work ethic, just football players.
Do you have an adjustable rate mortgage that is about to increase? Or first and second mortgage that you would like to combine into one? Low mortgage payment? Hey, give Keel Mortgage a call today. They are local, friendly, and have been serving families up and down the West Coast for over 3 decades. With interest rates forecasted to rise, the best time to explore your options is now. It starts with a phone call to 1-888-778-KIEL or online at keelmortgage.com. That's Keel Mortgage, 888-778-KIEL. They can help. CL 53969. Curiously, I think there's an argument in the league that, you know, obviously Bill Belichick, not only maybe the best coach in football now, but maybe one of the best ever. And I think Pete Carroll's getting acknowledged as being maybe the second best. How much have you seen Pete grow, and what did you see from Bill Belichick that made him special?
You know, Pete, the number one thing that I saw when he came back to the NFL, and you know, when people asked me when Pete got hired by the Seahawks how he was going to do, I said, I think he's going to be very successful. But the biggest change that he made in his second stint, or I guess his third stint, because he was with the Jets before the Patriots, but his third stint in the NFL, was that he made sure that he had some control over the player personnel department. And when he first got there, they had the highest turnover on their roster in the league by quite a bit, if I'm recalling correctly.
They brought in about 240 players.
Yeah, exactly. And so, And what Pete has done there is he's created a great culture inside their football organization where guys really want to be there. But then it's also a situation where guys know that the organization is continuously looking to replace them. And so you combine those two things where guys really want to play for the Seahawks because it's a great place to be, with an environment where they know they can be replaced, you know, any week, and guys will compete their butts off to try and stay there. You've seen them have a lot of success. And then they had some good fortune in the draft. Let's be honest. They had at one point, four or five Pro Bowlers that were on their rookie contracts, which that allows you with a salary cap, that allows you to build some real depth in your team. And now it's getting a lot harder for them now because some of their star players now are actually getting paid what they deserve to get paid. Makes it a lot harder for the Seahawks to maintain the kind of depth that they had in the past. With the Patriots, one of the things that makes them truly unique, they bring guys in and they really teach football. And that might seem obvious or you know, like a common sense kind of thing, but not a lot of teams do that. You know, there are a lot of teams out there that think that they can just, you know, bring a guy in and plug him into their system, and then he either plays well or they fire him and bring somebody else in. And the Patriots don't take that approach. They bring a guy in, and they start from the ground up. You know, with their offensive linemen, for example, whether you're a 10-year guy or a rookie, they start out the same way at the start of every camp, and they walk through very, very slowly the exact steps and position they want to take in pass protection. And then they go a little bit faster, and then they go a little bit faster. And I'm sure it's really annoying for a lot of the veterans to have to go back and do that at the start of every season. But because of that, you know, these guys that maybe you've never heard of or that were late-round draft picks or free agents can come on the field, and they know exactly what's expected of them and exactly how to do it, rather than just saying, hey, block that guy. They actually go and teach these guys how to do it. And then you watch, you know, with the receivers that have come through there, early on, maybe, you know, like Kevin Hogan now is an example where, I mean, shoot, he was a lacrosse player in college, and early on didn't hear much from him, and now he's a really legitimate receiver in the NFL, and that's because they really have taught him the game as he's grown up.
One of the pleasures of your current life is teaching your sons. You have a high school son who's playing quarterback, another son who's coming through the ranks at Washington State. Talk a little bit about them and what you're trying to teach them and how you're handling, you know, being somebody that has, you know, quarterbacks of college ability to be quarterbacks in football.
Well, I mean, first of all, coaching high school football is the most rewarding thing I've ever done. And it has almost zero to do with X's and O's. You know, having a chance to be around these high school boys when they're kind of 14 to 18 years old, you get a chance to have an impact that's a lot bigger than, you know, playing a football game. And so that part's been super rewarding, and being around my sons and their friends as they're growing up has just been an amazing experience. And so I've loved that. But in terms of developing young football players, it kind of goes back to what we were just talking about with the Patriots. You know, you every day have got to teach. You know, it can't be about X's and O's. I can't just put together a game plan and say, okay, well, go run this route and, you know, block it this way. You got to go teach them exactly how to do everything, and you build them that way. And for quarterbacks, it's for me as a guy that played it for a long time. I understand what the pictures are that they're looking at and how they're trying to make decisions, and I can see fairly quickly, in practice. Well, okay, he really understands that route, but maybe not this other one. So the other one doesn't understand and not as clear a picture to him, we'll either take it out or we'll go back and teach it until it does look like it's something that we can understand and execute. But I try not to be hard-headed about having, you know, some great idea that I'm convinced is going to work. If it doesn't look good in practice, we just take it out and just don't run it. Because if a guy doesn't have confidence in a play and is not sure, then he's not going to play fast and not going to execute properly.
Give us a scouting report of your sons.
John's up at Wazoo. He's redshirting this year. In his freshman year, he's redshirting up there. He's a really, really good player. He's 6'3", about 215. believe it or not, John, after watching me play, the kid can run a little bit. He got a little athletic ability from his mom, and so he's got some speed. But he's really accurate, highly intelligent, and you know, physically strong and tough player. And he's also an outstanding leader. Henry, who's a junior in high school, man, he's about 6'3" also, but he's a skinny little twerp. He's about 170 pounds, but he's got a little whip, man. He can sling the ball around and sees things really well. Pretty elusive, throws well on the run, and just a highly accurate guy.
What kind of ceilings do you think that they have?
Oh, geez, I don't know, man. I think if you'd you know, if you looked at me when I was a sophomore in high school, you wouldn't have thought that I had a real high ceiling. I was just so skinny and big feet and couldn't move around very well. But I don't know. I have no idea what the ceiling looks like for either one of them. They're both really good football players, and you know, it'll kind of be up to them to determine how high their ceiling is.
Another joy that you have is your wineries. Now, of course, I mean, I have Double Back. I mean, it's been great since it's come out, won awards. If you would have a competition right now from other NFL quarterbacks putting out wine, because I know Rick Meyer does it, Dan Marino, Damon Heward. I don't know how many others are in the wine business. How would that competition shake out?
Well, with the guys that you mentioned, it'd be a pretty good competition. You know, Damon and Dan at Passing Time and up there in Washington, they're making some truly world-class wines that are rated really, really highly. And then Rick Meyer with his Mirror Winery down in the Napa Valley, same deal, making truly world-class stuff. And you know, for us, you know, well, I'll back up even. When we initially took a look at getting into the wine business, the four of us were going to go into the business together. It was going to be me and Rick and Damon and Dan. We were going to have our own deal, and we were all going to throw in together and make some wine. And then we discovered that, you know, having four chiefs and no Indians didn't work very well, and we were scattered around the country. So I ended up, you know, doing my own deal, and then Rick did his, and then Damon and Dan partnered to do theirs. The cool thing is that, you know, I think that we are collectively establishing that, you know, these retired jocks can actually make great wine. You know, there are some other wineries out there with celebrity names attached to them that are really not making great wine. There's a stigma attached to it that we had to overcome. It actually ends up being a negative in some people's perception when you see somebody that was an actor or, you know, an athlete get into wine. There's a perception that, okay, well, that's just a celebrity endorsement and the wine's not very good. And so for us, you know, to know that my other quarterback buddies are actually putting out world-class wine actually helps our business. So it ends up not really being a competition between us as much as it is us competing against the rest of the world.
Because you were the first of the four and then had immediate success, what did you do right?
Well, I cheated. You know, I had some significant advantages when I got into the business. Number one, I went back to Walla Walla, which is my hometown. And so I had some advantages just because I grew up there. And then I was able to hire my next door neighbor at the outset of our winery, Chris Figgins, who grew up at Leonetti Cellars. And Chris was so instrumental in every aspect of our business when we started. He'd already developed a name for himself as one of the winemaking rock stars in the world, and he helped guide our business for the first 7 years. So that was a significant advantage that we had. And then his protege has now taken over as the winemaker for us. Coincidentally, he shares a name with the offensive coordinator from the Patriots, Josh McDaniels. But Josh has taken over the reins as our winemaker and general manager, and he's really taken us to new heights. So, you know, we were very, very focused from the outset and still to this day on quality first. And we made some very difficult financial decisions early on in our business to make sure that we only produced the very, very top quality wine that we could make from the Valley. And because of that, I think people have now, you know, discovered that, okay, this isn't just a passing interest, you know, for a retired jock. This is something we're really serious about. We got up there, oh, geez, 10 years ago. Our family went up and we planted vines with our own hands. I mean, we got up there, got our hands dirty and planted vines, and now that the vineyard that we planted up there is the backbone of our wine, and making we're growing some of the best fruit we think in the entire world, and it's showing through, you know, in the wine. And because of that, long term view on quality first, we've built a good business now. But it takes a friggin' long time, man. It took, I tell people we're a 10-year overnight success.
Of course, I mean, that's double back. Now, you got another one, the Bledsoe Family Wine. How did that start, and how is that doing?
You know, what we determine, John, you know, we're, again, quality first, and double back will always be the focus. But from a business standpoint and from a sales standpoint, not everybody wants to open a $100 bottle of wine, you know, on a Tuesday. And we wanted to be able to make wine at a price point that allowed more people to try the wine and then you know, maybe move on up eventually to double back. And so we started a sister winery called Bledsoe Family Winery. We currently have four wines that are being made there that are at more accessible price points. You know, the Cabernet is under $50 and the, you know, Chardonnay is like $32, I think. And so they're, you know, while it's still, you know, classified as premium wine, if you will, it's more accessible to more people. And it also allows us to bring in more fruit, make more wine, and then be more selective with the wine that we make about what ultimately goes into double back, and then the remainder of the wine goes into the other brands.
Well, it seems like your life is kind of aging as well as your wines. I congratulate you on that success, the success of your career, and having two sons that are kind of going up the ranks as quarterbacks. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, John. It's been a good run. I tell people I'm trying to go my whole life and never have a real job. You know, I got to play a game until my mid-30s, and now I get to be a winemaker. And you know, certainly neither profession is without its complications and stresses and all of that. But both have been really engaging and really interesting and fun things to be a part of. You know, it's been a good run so far.
Hey, Drew, thank you so much. Always great catching up with you.
Absolutely. Hey, and I've got to throw in a quick go Cougs. Man, we've got some developing situation up here in the Pacific Northwest with both the Cougs and the Huskies in the top 10. Hopefully they both keep winning, and that Apple Cup game at the end of the year will be hugely important.
Could you imagine what it's going to be like really if both teams are undefeated?
You know what? I'm not getting ahead of myself. You know, the both teams have to finish out their Pac-12 schedule, and we all know how tough the Pac-12 can be. But man, if that happened and they got to the end of the year and both teams were undefeated and they were playing for something really meaningful, man, that'd be fun.
It's a fun time right now, and I'm glad you're enjoying it because I know I'm enjoying it too. Drew, thanks so much.
Thanks, John. We'll talk to you again soon.
And that does it for this week's podcast. In between episodes, you can follow me on Twitter at ClaytonESPN. If you enjoy these weekly one-on-one conversations, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time on Schooled with a Professor.